right. The next case on the en banc calendar today is Larry Edward Adams v. State, case number 60606. Mr. Pichetta, welcome, and welcome back.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm grateful I'm not arguing a UCC case. I was terrible at it. I hesitate to call any case unique. I just think there's a lot of stuff I haven't seen. But we've looked, and we've had a hard time finding a case that it is all, at all comparable to this, where you have a conviction and death sentence that is imposed in large part on the basis of the testimony of an individual who testifies under false pretenses, who testifies using a false name, who perjures himself in court, and is in fact somebody entirely different, who has a criminal record, among other things, that he himself once said in a long ago proceeding, a record that was as long as his arm. What is, I think, unique about this case is that, maybe it's just my naivete, but I thought this would cause some sort of excitement in the district court because it's something that I've never seen before. And instead, it was met with a complete shrug. And I think it deserves a little more attention than that. And what we are asking for at this point, of course, is reversal of the district court's order.
Can we make an exception to procedural bars on the basis of perjured testimony?
On newly discovered evidence, yes, Your Honor, and on Brady. The reason that I think this court could, at this juncture, simply reverse the district court's order is that it's based on an assumption about the factual record that doesn't exist. What the district court, as usual in these cases, signed an order prepared by the district attorney's office, says is, well, this evidence was available all along. The fact that Joe Left-Hand Bull is really Lawrence Stanley Brashear was available all along. There's no citation to any evidence about that. In fact, we've cited and provided evidence both in the district court and again in the third supplement, which I'll get to in a moment, that it was pure dumb luck that we found this out. 25 years after the trial in this case, we found his Joe Left-Hand Bull's ex-wife purely by a fluke in an internet search and found out about Lawrence Stanley Brashear, who has a very extensive criminal record and who changed his name. He didn't formally change it. He just adopted a different name, clearly in order to avoid his past. Ms. Olson, the ex-wife, gave us a declaration that said, among other things, whenever she called him Stanley, he would beat her because he didn't want to be known as someone different. So I think on that limited basis, this court could and should reverse this for a full hearing on cause and prejudice so that we can show that on the basis of this newly discovered evidence and the Brady violation, we should get relief. But because of the history of procedural default in this jurisdiction and in habeas cases in capital matters, we attempted to follow what Mr. Owens has been championing for years, which is even if you do not have a fully fleshed out Brady claim, even if you haven't gotten to the end of your investigation, you have to go into court and you have to file something as soon as you can. So we filed our second supplement to the petition for writ of habeas corpus within about 5 months after getting the declaration from Sandra Olson and finding out how much or how little actually additional information we could get. That's the judgment that is before the court now. But we didn't stop investigating, and it turned out that, as we characterized it in the briefing, what we had when we filed in the district court first and what is before this court now is just the tip of the iceberg. We've also filed a motion for remand under Supreme Court Rule 250 sub 8, asking the court either to send this case back for further proceedings on the third supplement that we filed in the district court, or in the alternative, to defer submission of this matter until, under what our view of Foster versus Dinwall is, the district court can do whatever it thinks it can do in terms of addressing the third supplement, before we come back up, assuming the district court doesn't say she would grant relief at this point, so that we can get all of this done in one proceeding.
Is there any issue as to the checkered past of the trial attorney?
Well, the checkered past of the trial attorney, I think, this predated much of his checkered past. I think we should step back and look at the context of this particular capital trial. This was Mr. Weinstock's, not his first capital trial only. It was his first criminal trial, period. His first criminal trial ever. And he was facing Mr. Seaton, whom I think we all know something about, who was a ferocious advocate. And in terms of disclosure of exculpatory or impeaching information, perhaps not the most punctilious of people.
Did he have second, was there a second chair with him?
No, Your Honor. What is in the third supplement that is now pending, and which both Mr. Van Boskirk and we have presented to the court, includes what I think of as a somewhat smoking gun, which is the fact that the inference that Mr. Bull was allowed to abscond by the prosecution, I think, changes things considerably and makes the Brady allegations that we have made considerably more healthy. After the prelim, which is where Mr. Left-Hand Bull actually testified, he was in Sacramento where he was living, and he was arrested for driving a stolen car. And he was jailed because he had outstanding warrants from two other California counties at the time. And then he's released. Nobody knows why or how. We asked the court to draw the inference that it was a benefit for his testimony. And I think that's really the only likely inference. But it turns out that in the material that we have gathered since, the Fresno records show that they released Joe Left-Hand Bull because Detective Bell from Sacramento, who was working with the Metro detectives on this case, who first brought Joe Left-Hand Bull to the attention of the Metro detectives, he called the morning after Mr. Bull was arrested for driving the stolen car. He called Metro and told them that their witness had been arrested and was in jail. And the next day, Detective Bell called up the court and asked for his release on his own recognizance and for withdrawal of the warrants. And what do you know? Mr. Bull got out. And as you might expect, and as I think any prosecutor or any detective who knows that this is an individual who is living in a bread truck in a vacant lot, he might be considerably more difficult to find if he just goes in the wind. And sure enough, by the time of trial, he's gone. And in fact, in the papers where Mr. Seaton is telling the district court at trial in this case why Mr. Bull is unavailable as a witness, he refers to the fact that he was arrested and he had warrants and then he disappeared. It would seem to me that that would be an appropriate time for the prosecution to have disclosed, oh, yes, and He got out because we wanted him out. That, again, is an inference, but I think the timing. Detective Bell calls Metro and says, leaves a message that Bull has been arrested. We don't have the record because, as we've pointed out in the third supplement, the Sacramento Sheriff's Office has what it describes as a stack of records on Mr. Bull, but they won't give it to us because we don't have a subpoena or a court order. So we don't know if there is something in there that makes that connection clear. We don't know if there is something in the Metro or the District Attorney's Office files, because we have never gotten the complete Metro or District Attorney files in this case after years and years of litigation by other attorneys appointed for Mr. Adams. So even if the court is not willing to say, all right, this order from the district court dismissing the habeas petition is groundless because there is no evidence anywhere that suggests that anybody in the defense camp knew anything about Joe Left-Hand Bull's record or his real identity or anything else, is just totally groundless. Whereas the state, because they took his fingerprints at the time he gave his statement, they have had his identity in their hands the whole time. If they run those prints, if they had run those prints and said, oh, well, he really isn't Lawrence Stanley Brashear, I think we would have heard it by now. We haven't. So I think on that basis, you could just dismiss rather reverse the district court's order in this case, remand for further proceedings, which we could fold in to the litigation over the third supplement. If not...
What does the record show about when they first, when Sandra Olson or Sandra Bull or whatever her name is, when was her identity first made known to people, that Bull was married, had a wife named Sandra? Her name was Sandra Bull or Sandra Olson?
That was around before the time of trial. But it wasn't that her name was not available. It was nobody could find Joe Left-Hand Bull or Sandra Left-Hand Bull or anybody.
Well, okay, give me the or Sandra Bull. What does the record show about efforts to find her and interview her?
Well, as I say, we had...
I know you found her in 2010.
But in terms of looking up in, like, ancestry databases or things like that, those things didn't exist in 1986.
Understood.
In between, there were these efforts to find the Bulls, whom everyone assumed were still together, on Indian reservations, which was what Mr. Seaton relied on to show the diligence necessary to show that they were unavailable. Unfortunately, the question about whether Joe Left-Hand Bull was in any part Indian was answered when we found Mrs. Olson, and she said no. He wasn't Indian at all. It was just a name he adopted because he was thinking...
One of many.
Yes. I think we're up to 17 now. In order to hide more easily in an Indian reservation. But in terms of the assumption that somehow finding Sandra Bull or Joe Left-Hand Bull would have been perfectly easy for us to do, would then, I think, make it more difficult to accept Mr. Seaton's assertion that it was impossible to find him or them at the time of trial, and therefore his prior testimony had to be admitted. But I think whether you reverse this order now or you simply hold this appeal in abeyance and let Judge Early process whatever she can of the third supplement so that we can see what additional evidence there is, particularly what is in the hands of the state, I think that is what needs to be done. We're asking for a hearing. Could I reserve my little remaining time for rebuttal?
Yes, of course, Mr. Pichetta.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Van Bosburg.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. The Joe Left Hand Bull allegations do not establish a waiver of the bars or a Brady violation. There was no impediment external to the defense, and there was no suppression by the state. The district court correctly concluded that through due diligence, defense could have discovered all of this information. The key was Joe Left Hand Bull's wife. And defense knew that Joe Left Hand Bull had originally been located in Sacramento, California. That police department, prior to trial, authored a memo with the wife's name, and prior to trial, issued an arrest report noting the warrants, defense now argues. Additionally, every conviction relied upon by defense was a matter of public record. As to the third supplement that was just spoken of, that's not properly before this court. It was not part of the record that the district court relied upon. It's not something that this court should or can consider for the purposes of this appeal. Even if you did, I would submit that it's pretty much more of the same if you compare it to the exhibits that were submitted with the prior supplements.
Can I ask you about the fingerprints that were taken and how they were processed and what they would have shown and how they would have demonstrated all these other identities that apparently Mr. Bull had?
The reason they took the fingerprints is because Joe Left Hand Bull and Patrick Fitzgerald both told Detective Bell specific facts about the case, and they wanted to exclude them as suspects. So they took the fingerprints and compared them to the 32 prints found at the house. Once they excluded them, they did nothing else with the fingerprints.
And the reason they didn't go into a database to determine whether or not he had other identities or...
No, that's not something we do. I mean, unless we have reason to believe someone is thinking about their name, and we take a lot of fingerprints and we don't run them all.
The fact is, when was his true name disclosed or discovered?
The Federal Public Defender indicates his true name is, I forget the name they're offering, but they indicate in an affidavit that I believe it was discovered in 2010 through an internet search.
So your statement a moment ago that it was public record all his convictions, for example, his Washington extortion?
Yes, that would all be under the ultimate identity.
That would all be under Bashir. So, great, it's out there, but if you don't have the key to unlock that, which is the right name, how would you get to that?
And that's the point of the district court. The district court found that if they had talked to the wife, they could have found out this information, because the wife was the source of the alternate identification in 2010.
Isn't that the same thing as saying, well, if we would have run the prints, we would have found the right identity? You put an obligation on them that maybe they didn't have.
Well, the district court concluded that initial counsel was deficient for not searching out Joe Left Hand Bull's identification. So I would submit the way the litigation is set up at trial, the state doesn't have an obligation to do this kind of research unless we have a reason to believe, an obvious reason to believe, that this person is lying.
Don't you think we need an evidentiary hearing in the district court on all these issues, though?
No.
As to what they knew and when they knew it?
No.
What Weinstock knew and when he knew it, if he knew anything?
No.
What his investigator knew? He didn't even have an investigator.
Most of that's in the record. He did have an investigator. At the hearing on the state's motion to allow Bull's preliminary hearing testimony in, Mr. Seaton indicated the defense had looked for him. There, in his affidavit, there's quoting our investigator, quoting the defense investigator, saying he looked. I believe Mr. Weinstock indicated that his investigator contacted the DA investigator and said, could you find this guy? That information is already in the record. So there really is no need for an evidentiary hearing. And that's why the district court ruled without one.
But why weren't the fingerprints released to the defense?
I don't know that they even asked.
Well, I don't know that they knew you had them. Is there anything in the record showing that the defense was aware of the fingerprints that were in your possession?
They would have been in our file. I know Mr. Weinstock was invited to review the file. If he had seen them, he could have asked for them, but they were in the file. We don't go through our file and show each piece to the defense and say, you might be interested in this. We let them review the file.
So you believe the record would show that the prints were available to him on inspection of the file?
Correct. And even if he didn't have the prints available, backtracking through the police reports, from Sacramento, California. They've got the wife's name, and also they note the two arrest warrants that defense relies upon. So even without the fingerprints, defense had some indication that maybe they need to look into this guy, that they weren't just totally blindsided. There was information available to them that they could have used to put them on notice. But even if the court gets past good cause...
Well, I'd like you to address, in connection with that comment, Mr. Pichetta just represented to the court that there is simply nothing in the record that would have indicated to the defense the existence of the identity of the wife or these warrants in Sacramento.
Actually, I believe what he indicated was that the wife's name was in the pretrial memorandum. And he can correct me if I'm wrong.
Uh-huh.
But prior to trial, the Sacramento, California Police Department issued a memorandum that of their efforts to look for Joe Lefthambel, and they note the wife's name.
But none of these witnesses were available at trial.
The state was not able to find Joe Lefthambel. Apparently the defense was...
So they used the preliminary transcript? Is that what they used?
Yes, they used... The court concluded that Lefthambel was unavailable and allowed the preliminary hearing transcript in.
But is there any record to show the efforts made by the state to locate the wife?
As to the wife, no.
Okay.
As to Mr. Bo, yes. Mr.
And
C.
The wife's name would have been under Bo also, right? In the...
Yeah, I believe they had her as an alternate identity as well. I mean,
what do you mean they had her as an alternate?
They had her under Sandra Bo.
Okay, no other name. She had a single name, Sandra Bo.
Yeah, they would have needed to go and talk to her to discuss
yes,
this information.
Okay. That's. I'm just trying to be clear on it.
Okay. So Osborne was not included in the documents you just referenced.
I'm sorry?
Sandra Osborne
or Olson?
No,
Olson,
no, Olson
I
believe,
apologize.
The other name.
Yeah.
No, she was listed as, I believe, Sandra Jane Joe Lefthambel or something to that effect.
Huh. In the documents that were in possession in the police reports in Sacramento.
All of the police departments that were involved in this only knew them as the Bulls.
Okay.
You don't think that perjured testimony should be an exception to procedural bars?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
I think it should be subject to the same standard. For instance, in this case, if you look at the record, Joe Lefthambel's testimony wasn't the be-all, end-all of the state's case. There's no prejudice. To determine whether the perjured testimony, assuming it was perjured, hurt the case, we still have the same formula. Was there prejudice? Was there good cause?
But don't you think an evidentiary hearing is needed for that issue? I mean, we're making a lot of statements, but don't you think that Weinstock should testify and maybe even bring Sandra, whatever her name is, and maybe even find the other guy? I don't know. Don't you think an evidentiary hearing would be fair to this man who's on death row?
No, I don't believe it's fair to him. I believe that the structure we have in place specifically answers the question in a fair way. Even if you assume there's good cause, let's just look at prejudice. And that would be the question you'd be answering at an evidentiary hearing. Was there sufficient prejudice that his case was really hurt that we can't trust the outcome?
Well, that's why, as a former district judge, I would like the district judge to take a look at it first and then bring it to us with a record where we can review exactly what Weinstock was thinking and what he knew, when he knew it. This man has a very checkered past with this Supreme Court. And in 1986, I don't know if he was a better lawyer then or not, but the girl against Dan Seaton, who I did many times, was not an easy task for a first-time criminal lawyer to have his first trial as a death penalty case.
And what I'm trying to communicate to the court is what Mr. Weinstock knew or didn't know, what he did, all of that would fall under the good cause part of it. And if you assume, for the sake of argument, that they've got good cause, that somehow there's good cause, and look just at prejudice, on this record, there's insufficient prejudice to change the outcome.
Why don't you articulate that?
I would love to explain it. Defense, Joe Lefthambel wasn't the be-all, end-all of the
right.
state's case. From the beginning of this process, defense has been trying to tell every court that's looked at this, ignore the whole record, look just at Joe Lefthambel. The best example, on page 18 of their opening brief, they've got a beautiful quote from Mr. Seaton, a block quote talking about, and Joe Lefthambel said, they cite to volume 5, page 1245 of the record. Go read the page. What Seaton actually said, Joe Lefthambel and Patrick Fitzgerald said, every relevant fact sourced to both witnesses. Bull and Fitzgerald both knew Adams for about a month in Sacramento. Adams told Fitzgerald, and Fitzgerald testified about the $150,000 drug deal with the father-in-law, that he killed his wife because she was going to tell the father he was keeping the money, that the wife was shot in the head 3 times, that he shot his daughter between the eyes because she woke up. They want this court to ignore everything Fitzgerald testified to. Fitzgerald also put out some impeachment evidence.
But do we know that Fitzgerald wasn't enthralled to Bull also? I mean, to me, they were kind of together, and I haven't read the whole record, but my limited understanding is that Fitzgerald was sort of a tag-along to Bull. And if Bull is who they're trying to describe him as being, which is a con artist who exerts himself to his own gain, wouldn't it stand to reason that he would also turn Fitzgerald to his own ends like that? I mean, that it would have been useful to cross-examine Fitzgerald, in other words, on the pressure brought to bear on him by Bull.
And
that's the problem I have with that.
There's nothing in the record to support that. And in fact, if Fitzgerald was in Bull's pocket, you'd think he'd want to get his back. Yet on cross, he tells the jury that Joe Left-Hand Bull's a con artist. You think if he was out to back up Joe Left-Hand Bull, he wouldn't be tearing down the man's credibility that way.
And that's on the original trial record?
That's on the original trial record. During cross-examination, Patrick Fitzgerald labeled Joe Left-Hand Bull a con artist. Exact words.
But you just talked about the credibility of someone that we knew, now know, perjured himself.
They're indicating that Joe Left-Hand Bull perjured himself. As far as I know, the district court did not adopt those. They assumed, for purposes of applying the procedural bars, they simply assumed the allegations were correct. My point is, even if Joe Left-Hand Bull perjured himself that every word out of his mouth on that stand was a lie, every material fact he presented to the jury was corroborated by Patrick Fitzgerald. I believe the only real difference between their testimony was Bull was able to say that one of the guns was a 25, and he used some derogatory language that he attributed to Adams. On the other side of that, Fitzpatrick actually sort of acted out how Bull showed him he killed his daughter by cradling her head and holding the gun. So there's emotional stuff on both sides, but the relevant facts are essentially the same. So even if you discount Bull's testimony, it's meaningless because Fitzpatrick said everything.
Counsel, other than Fitzpatrick's testimony identifying Adams, is there any other evidence in the record that would address the prejudice prong?
Absolutely.
Why don't you go into that?
This trial was not Larry Adams versus Joe Left-Hand Bull. It wasn't even Larry Adams versus Bull and Fitzgerald. Larry Adams took the stand and made it an unwinnable credibility contest between himself and just about every other witness who testified. Everybody else was lying, mistaken, or just wrong. Tammy Miller was mistaken when she testified. She saw him with a 25 caliber handgun. Ronald Strang was lying when he testified that on the night of the murders, he and Larry Adams parked 4 spaces away from each other at the Horseshoe. And after they go into the casino, Larry Adams disappears after 15 minutes, and when Strang goes back to get his car, Larry Adams' car is gone. Ronald Strang lied when he testified on the night of the murders. Larry Adams has a full beard. The next day, he's down to a goatee and a mustache, shorter hair. According to Larry Adams, Ronald Strang also lied when Strang testified that Larry called him from jail and asked him to stretch the times they were together on the night of the murders. Defense also wants the court to ignore everything Fitzgerald, Left-Hand Bull, and Adams' little stepdaughter, Carrie Barr, testified to. In the record, in total, the evidence was that Larry Adams had access to a 22 or 25, the type of weapons used in the home, that his alibi that he presented to the police boiled down to his uncorroborated statement that the time of the murders, he was wandering alone through downtown Las Vegas for 4 or 5 hours looking for the people he had went to the Horseshoe with. That the parking ticket that he claimed substantiated his alibi was actually from June 23rd at 4:39 a.m., not the night of June 23rd, 24th, when the murders happened. That neighbors saw...
That was early in the morning of the
23rd. The day before. Yeah. 15 hours difference, essentially.
Yeah.
that neighbors saw a car consistent with Larry Adams' car parked in front of the Adams home on the night of the murders, that the intruder knew exactly where the drugs and money were hidden inside the fireplace, and Kerry Barr testified and told the jury that Larry Adams had threatened to kill her mother. May I finish?
Yes, go ahead.
That she saw him break her mom's nose, and on the night of the murders, the victim, the little girl victim, wakes her up and says, "Come, Daddy." Shortly thereafter from bed, Kerry hears mom exclaim, "Don't kill me," and hears a gunshot. I would submit this record is more than enough to address your concerns, Justice Cherry, about an evidentiary hearing, because taking away the Joe Left-Hand Bull evidence, even assuming that he was lying, there simply is insufficient evidence, insufficient prejudice to find a Brady violation or a waiver of the procedural bars.
Well, you can take it away for the, maybe the guilt of the phase, but how do you take his testimony away for the penalty phase?
Absolutely. If I can have the time, I'll address it.
I would wish that you could do that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Penalty phase, what was presented? Defense presented absolutely no mitigation evidence. Their entire argument was mercy and residual doubt. On the other side of that, on the other side of the balance, for the aggravators, you have Larry Adams putting a bullet between the eyes of his awake 3-year-old daughter from a distance of 3 feet. That's powerful aggravation evidence. And in the 30 years since this case has happened, since Larry pulled the trigger, defense has not even addressed that fact. They've done nothing to change it. And with that kind of powerful evidence in the record, it would be exceedingly difficult to establish prejudice. Thank you for your attention.
All right, Mr. Van Bosker, thank you for your argument. Mr. Pichetti, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I wish you'd talk about the prejudice here as to, I think the district attorney made a very strong argument about the fact they didn't even need Bull's testimony, that if it's Gerald and the rest of it, and the brutality of this killing certainly warranted a death penalty, Mr. Pichetti.
Remember, Your Honor, before Joe Left-Hand Bull, Mr. Adams was not even charged. He was not charged with these offenses before Joe Left-Hand Bull came up with these statements. Part of the statement that stated that the state relied on heavily at trial was, not only did he kill his wife and daughter, he also admitted killing a biker by injecting him with battery acid in Las Vegas. Where is the evidence of that in the penalty phase? Where is the evidence that that ever happened in the penalty phase? There is not, as far as I know, a shred of investigation by the state or by anybody. You would think if a biker were dead in Las Vegas of being injected with battery acid, Mr. Seaton would have heard about it. No. And I
think it doesn't go to the prejudice point, which I think I would echo Justice Cherry's comments. We need to hear about that.
That goes to his credibility, but Fitzgerald's credibility is wrapped up in this. When Bull gives his statement, he says, Adams told this to a bunch of people. Included in that bunch of people were two fellows, Don Magos and Raymond Best. And they interview those people. And Mr. Best says, I never heard anything like that. And by the way, that your left-hand bull is a con man. He'll con you out of your eye teeth if you let him. Mr. Best said he didn't hear anything either. Mr. Fitzgerald, in his testimony at trial, says, Ray Best heard that too. So where are we left with on this? In the statement of Mrs. Fitzgerald, she characterizes Best and, Joe Left-Hand Bull and Fitzgerald as the best friends. They try to minimize in their testimony and statements that they barely know each other at all. But in terms of what the prejudice is, I think you just have to step back and say, if all of this stuff was so persuasive, why was Mr. Adams never charged until Joe Left-Hand Bull turns up? And I think, as Your Honor said, Justice Pickering,
Fitzgerald and Bull have much more in common on this, and the extent to which they colluded in their testimony, and there is evidence that's in the third supplement that says Fitzgerald was told that Adams had put a hit out on him. There's no report of this anywhere else, and I think that came definitely from Joe Left-Hand Bull. So in terms of why Mr. Bull is coming up with this story, if you look at the Wisconsin extortion conviction, which is in the third supplement, he does the same thing. He finds some plausible story, and then he embroiders it. Everybody said, yes, Mr. Adams was talking about his wife and daughter, because this was something that had happened. It's this far for an accomplished con man to say yes, and he said he did it. And that's the tip that we're on here. In answer to the question about the prints, the fact that the prints may have been seen in, I don't know whether Mr. Weinstock saw them, they were seen by federal counsel at some point, but they didn't obtain copies of them. But the copies and the prints are meaningless unless you have the database. Only law enforcement can go to the FBI and say, run these prints against Warren Stanley Bashir's FBI number from Wisconsin and tell us, is this the same fellow?
What's the obligation on them to do that without, if they're talking to witnesses, do they have an obligation to do that in every case?
No, Your Honor. But here, remember, we have these wild accusations by Left-Hand Bull in the statement. He's telling the Sacramento Police Department that Larry Adams has a truck full of grenades. There's no police report from Sacramento saying, oh, yes, he had a truck full of grenades. Nobody believed it. Nobody believed that he had killed a biker by injecting him with battery acid in Las Vegas. They believed only what they needed to start this conviction. So the line is, all right, when you have a witness whose credibility is already suspect, and when he is arrested in Sacramento for driving the stolen car, actually it's Fresno County, gives his social security number as 35. Now, if the shoe were on the other foot, if my client had given us a social security number as 35, any prosecutor, any law enforcement officer would be saying, this person is trying to hide his identity because he's fabricating information.
Isn't that speculation? I mean, he wasn't a suspect, was he?
Well, he was certainly a suspect in the stolen car. But I don't know that there is a social security number that's 35. Wouldn't that make you nervous? Doesn't this make us nervous enough to have a hearing?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pichetto. Any other questions by the justices? Then this matter will stand submitted.